said. "Why? Because I got you a date with a handsome boy? For goodness sake, Minka, if I can't have fun, at least let me live vicariously through you." "I don't want to go out with Josik." "But Anya needs you to go out with him," Daria said. Anya, my character, who was too boring, too safe. "You can thank me later," she said, patting my hand. Astoria Cafe was a well-known hangout on Piotrkowska Street. At any given moment you might find Jewish intellectuals, playwrights, composers, arguing the finer points of artistic merit over smoky tables and bitter coffee, or opera divas sipping tea with lemon. Even though I was dressed in the same borrowed outfit I'd worn the day before, being in close quarters with these people made my head swim, as if I might become enlightened simply by breathing the same air. We were sitting near the swinging doors of the kitchen, and every time they opened, a delicious smell would waft over us. Josek and I were sharing a plate of pierogi and drinking coffee, which was, as he had promised, heavenly. "Upiori," he said, shaking his head. "That's not what I expected." I had been telling him, shyly, of the plot for my story, of Anya and her father the baker, of the monster who invades their town by masquerading as a common man. "My grandmother used to talk about them when she was still alive," I explained. "At night she would leave grain on the wooden table at the bakery, so that if an upyur came, he would be forced to count it until the sunrise. If I didn't go to bed when I was supposed to, my grandmother said the upyur would come for me and drink my blood."
"Pretty grisly," Josek said.
"The thing is, it didn't scare me. I used to feel bad for the upyur. I mean, it wasn't his fault he was undead. But good luck getting someone to believe that, when there were people like my grandmother running around saying otherwise." I looked up at Josek. "So I started to daydream a story about an upyur who may not be as evil as everyone thinks. At least, not compared to the human who's trying to destroy him, and certainly not in the eyes of the girl who's starting to fall for him, until she realizes he may have killed her own father."
"Wow," Josek said, impressed.
I laughed. "You were expecting a romance, maybe?"
"More than I was expecting a horror story," he admitted.
"Daria says that I have to tone it down, or no one will ever want to read it."
"But you don't believe that?"
"No," I said. "People have to experience things that terrify them. If they don't, how will they ever come to appreciate safety?" A slow smile spread across Josek's face. In that moment, he looked handsome. At least as handsome as Herr Bauer, if not more.
"I didn't realize Wudge had the next Janusz Korczak in its midst."
I fidgeted with my teaspoon. "So you don't think it's crazy for a girl to write something like this?" Josek leaned closer. "I think it's brilliant. I see what you're doing. It's not just a fairy tale. It's an allegory, right? The upiori, they are like Jews. To the general population, they are bloodsuckers, a dark and frightening tribe. They are to be feared and battled with weapons and crosses and holy water. And the Reich, which puts itself on the side of God, has commissioned itself to rid the world of monsters. But the upiori, they are timeless. No matter what they try to do to us, we Jews have been around too long to be forgotten or to be vanquished." once. In Herr Bauer's class, I had made an error during an essay and substituted one German word for another. I was writing about the merits of a parochial education, and meant to say Achtung, which meant attention, respect. Instead, I used Ächtung, which means ostracism. As you can imagine, it completely changed the point of my essay. Herr Bauer asked me to stay after class to have a discussion about the separation of church and state, and what it was like to be a Jew in a Catholic high school. I wasn't embarrassed at the time, because mostly I didn't even pay attention to what made me different from the other students, and because I got to spend a half hour alone with Herr Bauer, talking as if we were equals. And of course, it was a mistake. Not a stroke of brilliance that had led me to make the observation in my paper that Herr Bauer thought was so insightful. But I wasn't about to admit to that. Just like I'm not going to admit to Josek now that when I was writing my story, I never in a million years was thinking of it as a political statement. In fact, when I imagined Anya and her father, they were Jewish, like me. Well, I said, trying to make light of Josek's explanation, guess I can't put anything past you. You're something else, Minka Levin, he said. I've never met another girl like you. He threaded his fingers through mine. Then he lifted my hand and pressed his lips to it, suddenly a courtier. It was old world, and chivalrous, and made me shiver. I tried to remember every sensation, from the way all the colors in the cafe suddenly seemed brighter, to the electric current that danced over my palm like lightning in a summertime field. I wanted to be able to tell Daria every last detail. I wanted to write them into my story. Before I could finish my mental catalogue, though, Josek wrapped his hand around the back of my head, drew me closer, and kissed me. It was my first kiss. I could feel the pressure of Josek's fingers on my scalp and the scratchy wool of his sweater under my palm. My heart felt like fireworks must, when after finally being lit, all that gunpowder has somewhere to go. So, Josek said after a moment. I cleared my throat and looked around at the other patrons. I expected them all to be staring at us, but no. They were tangled in their own conversations, punctuating the air with gestures that cut through the haze of the cigarette smoke. I had a brief, flashing image of myself and Josek, living abroad and working together at our kitchen table. There he was, his white shirt sleeves rolled up to the elbows as he furiously typed a story on deadline. There I was, chewing the top end of a pencil as I added the final touches to my first novel. Josek Shapiro, I said, drawing back, what's gotten into you? He laughed. Must be all this talk of monsters and the ladies who love them. Daria would tell me to play hard to get, to walk out and make Josek come after me. To Daria, every relationship was a game. Me? I got tired of figuring out all the rules. Before I could answer, though, the doors of the cafe burst open, and a swarm of SS soldiers exploded into the room. They began to smack the patrons with their truncheons, to overturn chairs, with people still in them. Old men who fell to the floor were trampled or kicked. Women were thrown against the walls. I was frozen in place. I had been near SS soldiers when they passed, but never in the middle of an action like this one. The men all seemed to be over 6 feet tall, hulking brutes in heavy green wool uniforms. They had clenched fists and pale silver eyes that glittered the way Micah did.
They smelled like hatred. Josek grabbed me and shoved me behind him through the swinging kitchen doors. "Run, Minka," he whispered. "Run!" I did not want to leave Josek behind. I grabbed onto his sleeve, trying to pull him with me, but as I did, a soldier yanked on his other arm. The last thing I saw before I turned and sprinted was the blow that spun Josek in a slow pirouette, the blood running from his temple and broken nose. The soldiers were dragging out the cafe patrons and loading them into trucks when I climbed through the window of the kitchen and walked as normally as I could in the opposite direction. When I felt I was a safe distance away, I started to run. I twisted my ankle in the kitten heels, so I kicked them off and kept going barefoot, even though it was October and the soles of my feet were freezing. I did not stop running, not when I got a stitch in my side, or when I had to scatter a group of little beggar children like pigeons. Especially not when a woman pushing a cart of vegetables grabbed my arm to ask if I was all right. I ran for a half hour, until I was at my father's bakery. Basha was not at the cash register. Shopping with Mama, I assumed. But the bell that hung over the door rang so that my father would know someone had entered. He came out from the kitchen, his broad face glistening with sweat from the heat of the brick ovens, his beard dusted with flour. His delight at seeing me faded as he noticed my face. Makeup streaked with tears. My bare feet, my hair tumbling out of its pins. "Minusha!" he cried out. "What happened?" But I, who fancied myself a writer, couldn't find a single word to describe not only what I had seen, but how everything had changed, as if the earth had tilted slightly on its axis, ashamed of the sun, so that now we would have to learn to live in the dark. With a sob, I threw myself into his arms. I had tried so hard to be a cosmopolitan woman. As it turned out, all I wanted was to stay a little girl. But I had grown up in an instant. If the world hadn't been turned inside out that afternoon, I would have been punished. I would have been sent to my room without dinner, and barred from seeing Daria, or doing anything but my schoolwork for at least a week. Instead, when my mother heard what had happened, she held me tightly and would not let me out of her sight. Before we walked home, my father's arm tightly anchored around me and his eyes darting around the street as if he expected a threat to leap out of an alley at any minute. And why should he think any differently after what I had relayed to him? We went to the office where Josek's father worked as an accountant. My father knew his father from Shul. "Chaim," he said gravely, "we have news." He asked me to tell Josek's father everything, from the time we arrived at the cafe to the moment I saw a soldier hitting Josek with an iron rod. I watched the blood drain from his father's face, saw his eyes fill with tears. "They took people away in trucks," I said. "I don't know where." An internal battle played over the older man's face, as hope struggled with reason. "You'll see," my father said gently. "He'll come back." "Yes," Chaim nodded as if he needed to convince himself. He looked up then, as if he was surprised to see us still standing there. "I have to go. I must tell my wife." When Daria came after dinner time to find out about my date with Josek, I told my mother to make an excuse and say I wasn't feeling well. It was the truth, after all. That date seemed unrecognizable now, so badly tarnished by the firestorm of events that I couldn't remember what it used to look like. My father, who picked at the food on his plate that night, went out after the dishes were cleared. I was sitting on my bed, my eyes squeezed shut, conjugating German verbs. Ich habe Angst. Du hast Angst. Hat Angst. Wir haben Angst. We are afraid. Wir haben Angst. My mother came into my bedroom and sat down beside me. Do you think he's alive? I asked, the one question that no one had spoken out loud. Ach, Minusha, my mother said, that imagination of yours. But her hands were shaking, and she hid this by reaching for the brush on my nightstand. She turned me gently so that I was sitting with my back to her, and she began to brush out my hair in long, sweeping strokes, the way she used to when I was little. What we learned from information that leaked through the community in tiny staccato bursts like rapid gunfire was that the SS had rounded up 150 people from the Astoria that afternoon. They had taken them to headquarters and had interrogated the men and women individually, beating them with iron bars, with rubber clubs. They broke arms and fingers and demanded ransom payments of several hundred marks. Those who didn't have the money with them had to give the names of family members who might. 46 people were shot to death by the SS. 50 were freed after payment, and the rest were taken off to a prison in Radogosh. Josek had been one of the lucky ones. Although I hadn't seen him since that afternoon, my father told me he was back home with his family. Chaim, who like my father had Christian clients as well as Jews, had somehow made the arrangements for the money to be brought to SS headquarters in exchange for his son's freedom. He told everyone who would listen that if not for the bravery of Minka Levin, they might not have had such a happy ending. I had been thinking a lot about happy endings. I had been thinking about what Josek and I were speaking of moments before everything happened. Of villains and of heroes. The Upyur in my story, was he the one who terrorized others? Or was he the one being persecuted? I was sitting on the steps that led to the second floor of the school building one afternoon, while the rest of the students had religious studies. Although I was supposed to be crafting an essay, I was writing my story instead. I had just started a scene where an angry mob beats at Anya's door. My pencil could not keep up with my thoughts. I could feel my heart start to pound as I imagined the knock, the splinter of the wood against the weapons the townspeople had brought for the lynching. I could feel sweat breaking out along Anya's spine. I could hear their German accents through the thick cottage door. But the German accent I heard was actually Herr Bauer's. He sank down beside me on the step, our shoulders nearly bumping. My tongue swelled to 4 times its normal size. I could not have spoken aloud if my life depended on it. Fräulein Levin, he said, I wanted you to hear the news from me. The news? What news? Today is my last day here, he confessed in German. I will be going back to Stuttgart. But why? I stammered. We need you here. He smiled, that beautiful smile. My country apparently needs me too. Who will teach us? He shrugged. Father Czerniski will take over. Father Czerniski was a drunk, and I had no doubt the only German he knew was the word Lager. But I didn't need to say this out loud. Herr Bauer was thinking the same thing. You will continue to study on your own, he insisted fiercely. You will continue to excel.
Then Herr Bauer met my gaze, and for the first time in our acquaintance, he spoke Polish to me. It has been an honor and a privilege to teach you, he said. After he walked downstairs, I ran to the girls' bathroom and burst into tears. I cried for Herr Bauer and for Josik and for me. I cried because I would not be able to lose myself daydreaming about Herr Bauer anymore, which meant more time would be spent in reality. I cried because when I remembered my first kiss, I felt sick to my stomach. I cried because my world had become a raging ocean and I was drowning. Even after I splashed my face with cold water, my eyes were still red and puffy. When Father Jarmik asked if I was all right during Mass, I told him that we had received sad news the previous night about a cousin in Kraków. These days, no one would question that kind of response. When I left school that afternoon, headed directly to the bakery as usual, I thought I was seeing an apparition. Leaning on a lamppost across the street was Josik Shapiro. I gasped and ran to him. When I got closer, I could see the skin around his eyes was yellow and purple, all the jewel tones of a fading bruise, that he had a healing cut through the middle of his left eyebrow. I reached up to touch his face, but he caught my hand. One of his fingers was splinted. Careful, he said. It's still tender. What did they do to you? He pulled my hand down. Not here, he warned, looking around at the busy pedestrians. Still holding my hand, he tugged me away from the school. To anyone passing by, we might have looked like an ordinary couple, but I knew from the way Josik was holding on to me, tightly, as if he were drowning in quicksand and needed to be rescued, that this wasn't the case. I followed him blindly through a street market, past the fishmonger and the vegetable cart, into a narrow alley that ran between two buildings. When I slipped on cabbage rinds, he anchored me to his side. I could feel the heat of his arm around me. It felt like hope. He didn't stop until we had navigated a rabbit warren of cobbled pathways, until we were behind the service entrance of a building I did not even recognize. Whatever Josik wanted to say to me, I hoped that it didn't involve leaving me here alone to find my way back. I was so worried about you, he said finally. I didn't know if you'd gotten away. I'm much tougher than I look, I replied, raising my chin. As it turns out, Josik said quietly, I'm not. They beat me, Minka. They broke my finger to get me to tell them who my father was. I didn't want them to know. I thought they would go after him and hurt him too. But instead, they took his money. Why? I asked. What did you ever do to them? Josik looked down at me. I exist, he said softly. I bit my lip. I felt like crying again, but I didn't want to do it in front of Josik. I'm so sorry this happened to you, I said. I came to give you something, Josik said. My family leaves for St. Petersburg next week. My mother has an aunt who lives there. But, I said stupidly, wanting only to unhear the words he had just spoken, what about your job? There are newspapers in Russia, he smiled. Just a little bit. Maybe one day I will even be reading your Upyur story in one. He reached into his pocket. Things are going to get worse here before they get better. My father, he has business acquaintances, friends who are willing to do favors for him.
We are traveling to St. Petersburg with Christian papers. My eyes flew to his face. If you had Christian papers, you could go anywhere. You had the so-called proper documents to prove that you were Aryan. This meant a free pass from all restrictions, roundups, deportations. If Josek had had those papers a week ago, he would never have been beaten by the SS. Then again, he would never have been at Astoria Cafe either. My father wanted to make sure that what happened to me never will happen again. Solemnly, Josek unfolded the documents. They were, I realized, not for a boy his age. They were instead for a teenage girl. You saved my life. Now it's my turn to save yours. I backed away from the papers as if they might burst into flame. He couldn't get enough for your whole family, Josek explained. But, Minka, you could come with us. We would say you're my cousin. My parents will take care of you. I shook my head. How could I become part of your family, knowing I had left mine behind? Josek nodded. I thought you would say that. But take them. One day you may change your mind. He pressed the papers into my hand and closed my fingers around them. Then he pulled me into his arms. The papers were caught between our bodies, a wedge to drive us apart, like any other lie. Be well, Minka, Josek said, and he kissed me again. This time his mouth was angry against mine, as if he were communicating in a language I hadn't learned. An hour later, I was in the steamy belly of my father's bakery, eating the roll he made for me every day, with the special twisted crown on the top and a center of chocolate and cinnamon. At this time of day, we were alone. His employees came in before dawn to bake and left at midday. My legs were hooked around the stool where I sat, watching my father shape loaves. He set them to proof inside the flowered folds of a baker's couche, patting the round, dimpled rise of each one, supple as a baby's bottom. Inside my brassiere, the edges of my Christian papers seared my skin. I imagined getting undressed that night, finding the name of some goyishe girl tattooed over my breast. Josek's family is leaving, I announced. My father's hands, which were always moving, stilled over the dough. When did you see him? Today, after school. He wanted to say goodbye. My father nodded and pulled another clot of dough into a small rectangle. Are we going to leave town? I asked. If we did, Minusha, my father said, who would feed everyone else? It's more important that we're safe, especially with Basha having a baby. My father slammed his hand down on the butcher block, creating a small storm of flour. Do you think I cannot keep my own family safe? He bellowed. Do you think that's not important to me? No, Papa, I whispered. He walked around the counter and gripped my shoulders. Listen to me, he said. Family is everything to me. You are everything to me. I would tear this bakery down brick by brick with my own hands if it meant you wouldn't be harmed. I had never seen him like this. My father, who was always so sure of himself, always ready with a joke to defuse the most difficult situation, was barely holding himself together. Your name, Minka, short for Wilhelmina. You know what it means? Chosen protection. I will always choose to protect you."
He looked at me for a long moment and then sighed.
"I was going to save these for a Hanukkah gift, but I'm thinking maybe now is the time for a present."
I sat while he disappeared into the back room where he kept the records of shipments of grain and salt and butter. He returned with a burlap sack, its drawstring pulled tight as a spinster's mouth.
"Ah, Freilichen Hanukkah," he said. "A couple of months early, anyway."
With impatient hands, I yanked at the knots to untie the package. The burlap pooled around a shiny pair of black boots. They were new, which was a big deal. But they were nothing fancy, nothing that would make a girl rhapsodize over their fashionable stitching or style. "Thank you," I said, forcing a smile and hugging my father around the neck.
"These are one of a kind. No one else has a pair like them. You must promise me to wear these boots at all times, even when you are sleeping. You understand, Minka?"
He took one from my lap and reached for the knife he used to hack off bits of dough from the massive amoeba on the counter. Inserting the tip into a groove at the heel, he twisted, and the bottom of the sole snapped off. At first I could not understand why he was ruining my new present. Then I realized that inside this hidden compartment were several gold coins. A fortune. "No one knows they are in there," my father said, "except you and me." I thought of Josek's broken hand, of the SS soldiers demanding money from him. This was my father's insurance policy. He showed me how both heels opened, then fitted each back to the boot and whacked them a few times on the counter.
"Good as new," he said, and he handed the boots to me again. "And I mean it. I want you to wear them everywhere, every day. When it's cold, when it's hot, when you're going to the market, or when you're going dancing." He grinned at me. "Minka, make a note. I want to see you wearing them at my funeral."
I smiled back, relieved to be settled on familiar ground. "That may be a little tricky for you, don't you think?"
He laughed then, the big belly laugh that I always thought of when I thought of my father.
With my new boots cradled in my lap, I considered the secret we now shared. And the one we didn't. I never told my father about my Christian papers. Not then, not ever. Mostly because I knew he would force me to use them. As I finished the roll my father had baked just for me, I looked down at my blue sweater. On my shoulders, there was a dusting of flour that he had left behind when he grabbed me. I tried to brush it off, but it was no use. No matter what, I could see the faint handprints, as if I had been warned by a ghost. In November, there were changes. My father came home one day with yellow stars, which we were to wear on our clothing at all times. Łódź, our town, was being called Litzmannstadt by the German soldiers who overran it. More and more Jewish families were moving into the old town, or Bałuty, some by choice and some because the authorities had decided that the apartments and houses they had owned or rented for years should now be reserved for ethnic Germans. There were streets in town that we could no longer walk down, but instead had to take circuitous routes or bridges. We were not allowed to use public transportation or to leave home after dark. My sister's pregnancy became visible. Daria went on a few dates with a boy named David, and all of a sudden she thought she knew everything there was to know about love stories.
If you don't like what I'm writing, I said one day, then why don't you stop reading it?
It's not that I don't like it, Daria replied. I'm just trying to help you with realism.
Realism, to Daria, meant reliving her moments of passion with David so that my character, Anya, could have just as romantic a kiss. From the way Daria talked, you'd think David was a combination of the Green Fields actor Michael Goldstein and the Messiah.
Have you heard from Josek? She asked.
She wasn't saying it to be mean, but Daria must have realized that the odds of me getting mail were very slim. The post did not come and go with any regularity anymore. I preferred to think that Josek had written me often, maybe even two or three times a day, and that these missives were piling up somewhere at a dead letter office.
Well, she said when I shook my head, I'm sure he's just really busy.
We were at the studio where Daria practiced ballet three times a week. She was good, at least as proficient in her craft as I was in writing. She used to talk about joining a dance company, but these days no one talked about the future. I watched her pull on her jacket with its yellow star on the front shoulder and back, and wrap a scarf around her neck. The bit you wrote about consuming an upur's blood, she said. Did you make that up?
I shook my head. My grandmother used to tell me that.
Daria shuddered. It's creepy.
Good creepy or bad creepy?
She linked her arm through mine.
Good creepy, she said. People will want to read it, creepy.
I smiled. This was the Daria I knew, the Daria I missed because she was usually too busy fawning over her new boyfriend. Maybe tonight we can stay over together at my place, I suggested, as we walked out of the building, knowing that she was probably planning to go on a date with David. There was a barrage of soldiers passing as we exited, and instinctively we ducked our heads. Once when soldiers passed, I used to feel a cold ache in the pit of my stomach. Now it was so commonplace I didn't even notice. There was a buzz in the street. From a distance we could hear screams. What's happening? I asked. But Daria was already moving in that direction. In one of the squares, three men were hanging from gallows so new I could still smell the sap of the trees their timber had come from. A group of people had gathered. At the front of the crowd, a woman was weeping and trying to get to one of the dead men, but the soldiers wouldn't let her. What did they do? Daria asked. An elderly lady beside her replied, criticized Germans here in the city. The soldiers began to move through the crowd, telling people to go home. Somehow Daria got separated from me. I heard her calling my name, but I worked my way forward until I was standing at the edge of the gallows. The soldiers didn't pay attention to me. They were too busy dragging away the family of the deceased. This was the closest I had ever come to someone dead. At my grandmother's funeral, I was little, and all I remember is the coffin. The man who was now twisting like a leaf on an autumn tree looked like he was asleep. His neck was snapped at a strange angle, and his eyes were closed. His tongue protruded a little. There was a dark shadow in his pants where he must have urinated. Before or after, I wondered. I thought of all the blood and guts in the horror story I was writing, of the upur eating the heart of a victim, and realized that none of it mattered. The shock value was not in the gore. It was in the fact that a minute ago this man was alive, and now he wasn't. That afternoon, when my father and I walked past the gallows, He tried to distract me with conversation about our neighbors, about the bakery, about the weather, as if I did not notice the stiff forms of the men behind me. My parents argued that night. My mother said I should not be walking around town anymore. My father said that was impossible. How would I go to school? I fell asleep to their angry voices and had a nightmare. Daria and I were at the hanging, but this time, when I got closer to the body and it slowly rotated toward me so that I could see the face, it was Josek's. The next morning I ran to Daria's home. When her mother let me in, I was dumbfounded. The house, which was usually neat as a pin, was in total disarray. "It's time," Daria's mother told me. "We're going to the old town, where it's safer." I did not believe it was safer in the old town. I didn't think it would be safer until the British started winning the war. After all, they'd never lost one. So I knew it would only be a matter of time before Hitler and his Third Reich were conquered. "She's very upset, Minka," Daria's mother confided. "Maybe you will be able to cheer her up." Music from Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty seeped from beneath the closed door of Daria's room. When I walked inside, I saw that her rug had been rolled up, the way she sometimes did when she danced. But she wasn't dancing. She was sitting on the floor, cross-legged, crying. I cleared my throat. "I need your help. I'm totally stuck on page 56. Daria didn't even look at me. "It's this part where Anya goes to Alexander's home," I said, frantically making it up as I went. "Something has upset her. I just don't know what it is." I glanced at Daria. "At first I thought it was Alexander with another woman, but I don't think that's it at all." I did not think Daria was listening, but then she sighed. "Read it to me." So I did. Although there was nothing written on the page, I pulled word after word from my core, like silk for a spider's web, spinning a make-believe life. That's why we read fiction, isn't it? To remind us that whatever we suffer, we're not the only ones. "Death," Daria said when I was finished, when the last sentence hovered like a cliff. "She needs to see someone die."
"Why?"
"Because what else would scare her more?" Daria asked, and I knew she wasn't talking about my story any longer. I took a pencil out of my pocket and made notes. "Death," I repeated. I smiled at my best friend. "What would I do without you?" That, I realized too late, was exactly the wrong thing to say. Daria burst into tears. "I don't want to leave." I sat down beside her and hugged her tight. "I don't want you to leave," I agreed. "I'll never get to see David," she sobbed, "or you." She was so upset I didn't even get jealous about being the second party in that sentence. "You're just going across town, not to Siberia." But I knew that meant nothing. Every day, a new wall appeared. A fence. A detour. Every day, the buffer zone between the Germans in this city and the Jews grew thicker and thicker. Eventually it would force us into the old city, like Daria's family, or it would shove us out of Łódź completely. "This isn't the way it was supposed to happen," Daria said. "We were supposed to go to university and then move to London." "Maybe we will one day," I replied. "And maybe we'll be hanged like those men." "Daria, don't say that. You can't tell me you haven't thought about it," she accused. And she was right, of course. Why them, when everyone had spoken badly of the Germans? Were they louder than the rest of us? or were they just picked at random to make a point? On Daria's bed were two boxes, a ball of twine, and a knife for cutting it. I grabbed the knife and sliced the fleshy center of my palm. "Best friends forever," I vowed, and handed her the knife. Without hesitation, she cut her own palm. "Best friends," she said. We pressed our hands together, a promise sealed in blood. I knew it didn't work this way, because I had studied biology at gymnasium, but I liked the thought of Daria's blood running through my veins. It made it easier to believe I was keeping a piece of her with me. 2 days later, Daria's family joined the long line of Jewish families snaking out of this part of town toward Bavuchi, with as many possessions as they could haul. On that same day, the men who had been hanged were finally allowed to be cut down. This was clearly meant as an insult, since burial in our religion was meant to happen as quickly as possible. During that 48-hour stretch, I passed the gallows 6 times. Going to the bakery, to Daria's, to school. After the first 2 times, I stopped noticing. It was as if death had become part of the landscape. My nephew, Meyer Kaminsky, was a Shainapunim. It was March 1940, and he was 6 weeks old. And already he smiled back if you smiled at him. He could hold up the weight of his own head. He had blue eyes and jet hair and a gummy grin that my father used to say could melt even Hitler's black heart. Never had a baby been so beloved by Basha and Rubin, who gazed at him like he was a miracle every time they passed by his bassinet, and by my father, who was already trying to teach him recipes, and by myself, who made up nonsense lyrics to lullabies for him. Only my mother was distant. Sure, she quelled about her grandson, and she cooed at him when Basha and Rubin brought him to visit, but she rarely held Meyer. If Basha passed him into her arms, my mother would find an excuse to put him down, or to shuffle him to me or my father instead. It didn't make any sense to me. She had wanted to be a grandmother forever, and now that she was one, she couldn't even bear to cuddle her grandchild? My mother always saved the best food for Friday nights, because my sister and Reuben came for Shabbat dinner. There were usually potatoes and root vegetables in our rations, but tonight, somehow, my mother had purchased a chicken. A food we had not seen in months, since Germany occupied the country. There were black markets all over town where you could get just about anything for a price. The question was, what had she traded in return for this feast? I was salivating so badly, though, I almost didn't care. I fidgeted during the prayer over the candles, and the kiddush over the wine, and the hamoitzi over my father's delicious challah, and then, finally, it was time to sit down and eat. "Hannah," my father sighed, biting into the first bite of the chicken, "you are truly a marvel." At first, none of us spoke. We were that occupied with the delicious food. But then Rubin interrupted the silence. "Herschel Berkovich, who works with me, he was ordered to leave his home last week."
"Did he go?" my mother asked.
"No."
"And?" my father said, his fork paused en route to his mouth. Rubin shrugged.
"Nothing so far." "You see, Hannah, I was right. I'm always right. You refuse to move and the sky doesn't fall on your head. Nothing happens.
On February 8th, the chief of police had listed streets where Jews were allowed to live and posted a calendar citing when the rest were supposed to leave. Although at this point everyone knew a family that had gone east to Russia or into the area of the town allotted for Jews, others, like my father, were resistant to leave.
"What can they do?" he said, shrugging. "Kick us all out?"
He patted his mouth with his napkin.
"Now, I will not let this glorious meal be ruined with talk of politics. Minka, tell Reuben what you were telling me about mustard gas the other day."
It was something I had learned in chemistry class. The reason mustard gas worked was that it was made in part of chlorine, which had such a tight atomic structure that it sucked electrons in from whatever it came in contact with, including human lungs. It literally ripped apart the cells of your body. "This is what passes for dinner conversation now?" my mother sighed. She turned to Basha, who was cradling Maya in her left arm. "How's my angel sleeping? Through the night yet?" Suddenly, there was a pounding at the door. "You're expecting someone?" my mother asked, looking at my father as she went to answer it. Before she could reach the door, however, it flew open, and three soldiers burst into the parlor.
"Get out," one of the officers said in German. "You have 5 minutes."
"Minka,"
my mother cried, "what do they want?"
So I translated, my heart pounding. Basha was hiding in the corner, trying to make the baby invisible. They were Wehrmacht soldiers.
One of them swept the crystal off my great-grandmother's oak server so that it shattered on the floor. Another overturned the table with all our food on it, the candles still burning. Reuben stamped out the flames before they could spread. "Go," the officer shouted. "What are you waiting for?"
My father, my brave, strong father, cowered with his hands over his head.
"Outside in 5 minutes, or we come back in and start to shoot," the officer said. And he and his comrades stormed out of our apartment.
I didn't translate that part. My mother was the one who moved first.
"Abram, get your mother's silver from the server. Minka, you take the pillowcases and go around and collect anything that has value. Basha, Reuben, how fast can you go home and gather your things? I'll stay with the baby until you get back."
It was a call to action that we needed. My father began rummaging through the drawers of the server, and then he started to move books from the shelves and reach into jars in the kitchen cabinets, collecting money that I had not known was hidden there. My mother settled Meyer in his bassinet, although he was screaming, and began to collect winter coats and woolen scarves, hats and mittens, warm clothing. I flew into my parents' bedroom and took my mother's jewelry, my father's tefillin and talis. In my own room, I looked around. What would you take with you if you had to pack up your life in only 5 minutes? I took the newest dress I owned and its matching coat, the one I had worn for the High Holy Days last fall. I took several changes of underwear and a toothbrush. I took my notebook, of course, and a stash of pencils and pens. I took a copy of The Diary of a Lost Girl by Margarete Böhme, in its original German, a novel I had found at a second-hand store and had hidden from my parents because of its racy subject matter. I took an exam upon which Herr Bauer had written "Exceptional Student" in German. I took the Christian papers Josek had given me, hidden inside the boots my father had made me promise to wear at all times. I found my mother standing in the center of the dining room, surrounded by the broken crystal. She was holding Meyer in her arms and whispering to him. "I prayed you'd be a girl," she said. "Mama?" I murmured. When she looked up at me, she was crying. Mrs. Szymanski, she would have raised a little girl like her own. I felt like my mind was filled with mud. She wanted to give Meyer, our Meyer, away? To be raised by someone other than Basha and Reuben? Was that why she'd agreed to watch the baby while they ran home to pack? Yes, I realized, in a moment of painful clarity, because it was the way to keep him safe. It was why families had shipped their children to England and the United States. It was why Josek's family thought I should go with them to St. Petersburg. With survival comes sacrifice. I looked down at Meyer's tiny face, his waving hands. Then give him to her, right now, I urge. I won't tell Basha. She shook her head. Minka, he's a boy. For a moment I just blinked at her, and then I realized what my mother was talking about. Meyer, of course, had had his bris. He was circumcised. If the Szymanskis told authorities their little girl was Christian, there would be no way to prove otherwise. But a little boy, well, all you had to do was open his diaper. I realized, too, why my mother had not wanted to cuddle her grandson. Deep down, she knew she should not become attached, in case she lost him. My father appeared, a rucksack on his back and pillowcases stuffed to the breaking point in each hand. We must go, he said, but my mother did not budge. I could hear screams as the soldiers worked their way through the homes of our neighbors. My mother flinched. Let's wait downstairs for Basha, I suggested. Only then did I notice her watch was missing. It was what she had traded for the chicken, I guessed. The chicken, which now lay unfinished on the floor of the dining room, the meal she had cooked to give the rest of her family the illusion that everything was going to be just fine. Mama, I said gently, come with me. It was the first time I remember acting like the grown-up, being the one to take my mother's hand instead of the other way around. My father had a cousin who lived in Bałuty, and in this we were lucky. People who were evicted and who knew no one had to get assigned a room by the authorities. The authorities, in the case of the Jewish ghetto, were the Judenrat, which was headed by one man, Chaim Rumkowski, the chairman, the eldest of the Jews. My mother had never liked my father's cousins. They were poor and lower class, and in this they were an embarrassment to her. When they came to our home for my sister's wedding dinner, my cousin Rivke kept holding things up to the light as if she were an appraiser, saying, "And how much do you think this cost?" My mother had huffed and muttered and made my father swear that she would not have to suffer their company again in her own home. It was ironic, then, to find ourselves on their doorstep, in the position of beggars, to see my mother, with her mouth pinched shut, at the mercy of their good graces. In the 4 square kilometers that the Germans had decreed to be the Jewish part of town, there were 160,000 people. 4 or 5 families crowded into apartments meant for one. 1/2 of these homes had a bathroom. We were in one of them, and for this I gave thanks every day. The ghetto was surrounded by a fence made of wood and barbed wire. A month after we arrived, it was completely sealed off from the rest of Łódź. There were fabriken, factories, some in warehouses, but many in bedrooms and basements, where people worked, making boots, uniforms, gloves, textiles, furs. It had been Chairman Rumkowski's idea to become indispensable to the Germans, to be such a useful group of workers that they would come to see how badly they needed us. In return for our making what they needed for the war effort, they would pay us in food. My father got a job baking bread for the ghetto. Mordechai Lazarovich was the head of the ghetto bakeries, and he reported to Chairman Rumkovsky. There were times when no flour or grains came in a shipment, and there weren't enough ingredients to bake. My father didn't hire his own bakers. They were assigned by Rumkovsky. The loudspeakers that blared all day in German in the squares would tell people who needed work to assemble every morning, and they would be directed to this fabrique or another. My mother, who had not worked while I was growing up, now got a job as a seamstress in a fur shop. Until then, I hadn't even known that she could hem. We'd taken our clothes to a tailor in the past. In only a few weeks' time, my mother had calluses on her fingers from needle sticks, and she started to squint from the poor light in the factory. We split the food she received in payment with Basha and Rubin because Basha had to stay home with the baby. Except for the fact that my mother, father, and I all shared a tiny room now, I did not mind living in the ghetto. I had more time to write my story. I got to go to school with Daria again, at least at first, until they closed all the schools. In the afternoons, we would go to the apartment she shared with two other families, none of whom had children, and we'd play card games. Often, because of the curfew, I would stay over at Daria's. Being in the ghetto sometimes felt like we were living in a cage, but it was a wonderful cage if you were 15 years old. My friends and family surrounded me. It felt safe. I believed that if I stayed where I was supposed to be, I'd be protected. In the late summer, when there was no bread in the ghetto because no flour had been brought in, my father became frantic. He considered it his personal responsibility to feed his neighbors. Thousands of people marched in the streets, while my father pulled the shades down at the bakery and hid in the back, afraid of the mob. "We are hungry," the chant swelled in the heat, like dough rising. The German police shot into the air to disperse everyone. There was more and more shooting as people kept pouring into the ghetto, but its boundaries remained fixed. Where were they all supposed to go? What were they supposed to eat? Although by the winter there was full-scale rationing, there was never enough. Every 2 weeks, we each got 100 grams of potatoes, 350 grams of beets, 300 grams of rye flour, 60 grams of peas, 100 grams of rye flakes, 150 grams of sugar, 200 grams of marmalade, 150 grams of butter, and 2,500 grams of rye bread. Working in a bakery, my father got an extra portion of bread during the day, which he always saved for me. Of course, he could no longer bake me my special roll. In the winter, the bakery closed down again. This time it wasn't because they ran out of flour, but because there was no fuel. No wood had been supplied to the ghetto, and only a little coal. My father and his cousin and Rubin took apart fences and ruined buildings and carried the wood back home so that we would have something to burn. One morning I found my cousin Rivke tearing up floorboards in a closet. "Who needs a floor in a pantry?" she said when she saw me watching. Yet even with all these extreme measures, people were freezing to death at night in their homes. The Chronicle, the newspaper that detailed everything that happened in the ghetto, reported on the casualties every day. Suddenly, being here didn't seem so safe anymore. One afternoon, Daria and I were walking to her home from school. It was frigid, and a wind whipped out of the north that made it even colder than the thermometer suggested. We huddled with our arms linked as we crossed the bridge at Zgierska Street, which Jews were not allowed to walk down anymore. A trolley was passing, and standing on the platform of the car was a woman in a long fur coat, her legs in silk stockings. "Who would be stupid enough to wear silk stockings on a day like today?" I murmured, thankful for the woolen leggings I had on, double layers. When we had scrambled to leave our home, I had taken silly things like party dresses and colored pencils, but my parents had had the foresight to take our winter coats and sweaters. Unlike some of the others in the ghetto, we at least had warm clothing to weather this horrible winter. Daria didn't answer. I saw her staring at the woman as the trolley passed. "If I had them," she said, "I'd wear them. Just because." I squeezed her arm. "Someday we'll both wear silk stockings." When we reached Daria's apartment, it was empty. Everyone else was still at work. "It's freezing in here," Daria said, rubbing her hands together. Neither of us bothered to take off our coats. "I know," I said. "I can't feel my toes." "I have an idea to warm us up." Daria dumped her book bag on the floor and turned on the record player. Instead of putting on popular music, though, she found one of her old classical records. She started to dance, slowly at first, so that I could follow along. I laughed as I tried. I was clumsy on a good day, and here I was trying to be graceful in my winter coat and many layers. Impossible. Eventually I collapsed to the floor. "I leave the dancing to you," I told Daria. But it had worked. I was winded, and my cheeks were pink and warm. Instead, I took out my notebook and read over the pages I had written last night. My book was taking a turn, now that I had been relocated to the ghetto. Suddenly the charming little village I had created was more sinister. A prison. I had lost sight of who was a hero and who was a villain. The dire circumstances in which I had set my story made everyone a little bit of both. The most detailed descriptions were of the smell of the bread in Anya's father's bakery. Sometimes, when I wrote about smearing a slice with fresh butter, I found myself salivating. I could not conjure food for myself, and had not had anything but watery soup for months, but I could imagine so vividly what I was missing that my belly ached. The other thing I could write about now was blood. God knows I had seen enough of it. In the few months I had been here, I had seen 3 people shot by German soldiers. One was standing too close to the ghetto fence, so a guard shot him. 2 were women fighting noisily over a loaf of bread. The officer who approached to stop the argument shot them both, took the bread, and threw it in a puddle of mud. Here's what I now knew about blood. It was brighter than you would imagine, the color of the deepest rubies, until it dried, sticky and black. It smelled like sugar and metal. It was impossible to get out of your clothes. I had come to see, too, that all my characters and I were motivated by the same inspiration. Whether it was power they sought, or revenge, or love. Well, those were all just different forms of hunger. The bigger the hole inside you, the more desperate you became to fill it. As I wrote, Daria kept dancing, turning, whipping her head at the last possible moment in a circle of chaînés and piqué turns. She looked like she might be able to bore a hole through the floor with the chisel made by her feet. As she moved with dizzying speed, I put down my notebook and started to clap. That was when I noticed the policeman peering through the window.
"Daria!"
I hissed, slipping my notebook underneath my sweater. I jerked my head in the direction of the window, and her eyes grew wide. "What should we do?" she asked. There were two police forces in the ghetto, one made of Jews, who wore the Star of David like the rest of us, and the German police. Although they both enforced the rules, which was a challenge because the rules changed daily, there were significant differences between them. When we passed German policemen on the street, we would bow our heads, and boys would remove their hats. Otherwise, we had no contact with them. "Maybe he'll go away," I say, averting my eyes, but the German rapped on the window pane and pointed to the door. I opened it, my heart pounding so loud that I thought for certain he could hear it. The officer was young and slight, like Herr Bauer. And if not for the fact that he was wearing a dark uniform I had learned to be terrified of, Daria and I might even have giggled behind our hands about how handsome he was.
"What are you doing in here?" he demanded.
I answered him in German. "My friend is a dancer." He raised his eyebrows, surprised to hear me speaking his language.
"I can see that."
I didn't know if there was maybe a new law that we couldn't dance here in the ghetto, or if Daria had unwittingly offended the soldier by playing the music loud enough to be heard through the windows, or because he didn't like ballet. Or if he was just in the mood to hurt someone. I had seen soldiers kick elderly men on the street as they passed, simply because they could. In that moment, I wished desperately for my father.